We'll hear argument first this morning in number 86772, the City of St. Louis versus Prapotnick. Mr. Wilson, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. This proceeding brought under Section 1983 involves the imposition of municipal liability upon the petitioner for the single isolated act of a city official who lacked general authority in the area and whose action was contrary to the policy of the city. This is a Monell-type case. In Monell, this court indicated that it was going to leave to future decisions the full contours of municipal liability. It is our position in respect to single incidents that this court has shaped those contours in its decisions in cases such as Owens, Tuttle, and particularly the recent Pembauer decision. And what this proceeding calls for is an application of those principles to the facts herein. The facts are largely undisputed. The plaintiff was a civil service employee of the City of St. Louis. He was a planner for our Community Development Commission. Around 1980, he became embroiled in a dispute with his supervisor. This led to a 15-day suspension for violation of a secondary employment rule. He appealed to our Civil Service Commission, which reduced that to a reprimand. In April 1981, because of a change of administrations, the new mayor appointed a defendant, Frank Hampshire, as the head of the Community Development Agency. Approximately 1 year later, Mr. Hampshire, as director of that agency, transferred the plaintiff to another city department. He filed an appeal with the Civil Service Commission. The Civil Service Commission declined that appeal on the basis that no injury was done to him at that time, since this was a lateral transfer. Subsequent to that, the plaintiff filed a 1983 action naming three city officials and the city as defendants. The defendant Hampshire was one of those named. The plaintiff was subsequently laid off from his position some 17 months after the transfer. He took an appeal from that layoff, and that appeal has been deferred, awaiting the outcome of this proceeding. We believe the question is whether or not the acts of the defendant Hampshire in transferring the plaintiff fall within the language of Monell, which imposes liability for acts which can be said to fairly represent governmental policy. Now, the court below, when the trial court rendered through a jury verdict a judgment against the City of St. Louis, it exonerated the three individual defendants. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, determined that the jury had found that the act of transfer was a retaliatory act on the part of the defendant Hampshire, and he was impermissibly motivated and caused constitutional injury to the plaintiff, who had been exercising his right of First Amendment by appealing to the Civil Service Commission. The Eighth Circuit determined that the defendant Hampshire was a policymaker, and his action, therefore, in transferring the plaintiff bound the City of St. Louis, so that Monell-type liability was imposed upon the city as a policymaker. It is our position that the crux of this matter involves the distinction between a city official who has the discretion to act, in this case the discretion to hire and fire and transfer employees, as opposed to the authority of a policymaker. In this case, it would be the authority to set employment policy for the City of St. Louis. Clearly, the defendant Hampshire had the former, the discretionary power to hire, fire, and transfer employees. But nowhere in the record is there presented any evidence that the defendant Hampshire was a policymaker for purposes of setting the employment policy of the City of St. Louis. The Court of Appeals misconstrued Pembauer. They adopted, in their opinion, what has been labeled the final authority test, which the court said was a two-prong test to determine Monell liability. First,
Wilson, may I ask you a question before you get into the more details? Is it your view that the question whether a particular agent of the city is a policy-making official is a question of fact or a question of law?
Clearly a question of law.
So then it doesn't, I mean, and your point is that regardless of what the evidence was, since he didn't, I mean, with regard to a particular transaction, he could not qualify.
Yes, that would be correct. The record does not support any imposition of liability upon the city.
The judge shouldn't have even given the jury the instruction on if you find him to be a policy-making official. So that was error, too, then.
That's correct. It should have never reached that point. We do not believe that a submissible case was made under these facts.
Well, Mr. Wilson, the jury was instructed that they could determine, in effect, whether the named defendants were policymakers. Were they not? That was part of the instruction.
They were instructed that high government officials could be held.
And you did not object to that instruction. In fact, I guess it was one that you prepared.
Yes, that's correct.
But now you say that was wrong.
Yes, the instructions were totally inadequate. But what we're presenting here and what we have preserved is the error in overruling our motions for directed verdicts, which we made at each critical stage in respect to the sufficiency of the evidence to impose under any proper standard liability.
Was there evidence in the record from which the jury might have concluded that the mayor or a member of the mayor's cabinet or council had approved the transfer knowing that it was in retaliation for?
Well, the jury would have had to follow the instructions, I think. And the verdict directing instruction only named the three defendants, Hampshire and two other supervisors. It did not name the mayor.
Well, I asked you whether there was evidence in the record from which a jury might have concluded that the mayor or member of his council or cabinet had approved the transfer knowing it was in retaliation.
There's nothing in my interpretation of the record, there's nothing in there that would support that inference. There is some allusions to the mayor. Mm-hmm. I think there's an allusion that the mayor knew that there was a transfer of functions from one department to another. But that was different than having knowledge particularly of this plaintiff. So our answer would be no. Although the mayor was never named in the verdict director by the plaintiff in this particular instance. We believe that the test of the final authority test that the Eighth Circuit placed in its opinion is erroneous. It's contrary to Pembauer. The delegated authority to act, I think, may be categorized as discretion. And this Court made clear in Pembauer in Part 2B that discretion is not enough to impose liability. If I may quote, the official must be responsible for establishing final government policy respecting such activity. Aside from the being contrary to Pembauer, the test promoted by the Eighth Circuit, its opinion, is unreasonable. The question of delegating out authority is one that runs throughout all of city officialdom or in employment. We could not conduct business without delegating out discretion to employees all the way down the line. Also, the second part of the test, the lack of de novo review, is equally unreasonable. There are countless decisions that are made every day operationally that there is no apparatus to provide review. We use an example, the police officer in Tuttle who was involved in the shooting. There would have been nothing that would have provided reasonably any review for that act prior to what had occurred. We believe the test is totally unreasonable, but the main point is it is contrary to the opinions, most of the opinions that were rendered in Pembauer. The plurality opinion, I think clearly, which relies upon as a basis the identification of a policymaker. And the policymaker identification is arrived at by an inquiry into state law as to the authority of that official to set policy. Here, I believe you have a contrast in Pembauer between the official who was held liable and the defendant Hampshire, who we assert should not have been considered to be a policymaker. The prosecutor in Pembauer was an elected countywide official. The Sixth Circuit had held, clearly interpreting Ohio law, that he was the chief law enforcement officer for that particular county. He was not answerable or responsible in respect to any of his conduct other than to the voters. There were no parameters or criteria that circumscribed his action. Here, in respect to Hampshire, our purported policymaker, the record is very sparse, but we do know he's appointed by the mayor. He's a functionary in respect to approving development plans for the city and in administering community development funds.
Mr. Wilson, as the case comes to us, I gather that the only argument that there is a policymaker here is that it's Hampshire?
Yes, this is what the Eighth Circuit construed the jury verdict to be, that the defendant Hampshire made a retaliatory act.
Well, does the respondent argue differently? Does the respondent identify anyone else as a policymaker except Hampshire?
The respondent did in their verdict directing instruction, Your Honor, the two other supervisors, one who succeeded Hampshire. The evidence is almost non-existent, the defendant Patterson, in respect to that.
What does the respondent argue here?
I believe the respondent
just defends the Eighth Circuit decision, is that it?
No, the respondent has abandoned the Eighth Circuit decision in respect to the test, the final authority test. I don't believe the respondent has abandoned the Eighth Circuit determination of what the jury did was find that Frank Hampshire made an impermissibly motivated unconstitutional act by reason of retaliatory transfer. That would be our interpretation of the respondent's brief.
Well, the Eighth Circuit exonerated the other two, did it not?
Yes.
Or did the jury do it?
Well, the jury exonerated all the individual defendants.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Eighth Circuit focused in upholding the verdict on the defendant Hampshire, that his single act of transferring was a retaliatory act for filing the civil service appeal. He's the only one that would have had the ability to have made the transfer under our...
Well, and that act represented city policy.
Yes, that's right. That was their categorization of what the jury had determined. I think the difference between our prosecutor in Pembauer and the defendant Hampshire here is Hampshire's discretion to hire and fire was subject to civil service rules and our entire civil service system. He was not unfettered in making employment decisions in respect to his particular employees. I think there was a number of appeals that the plaintiff made and that he received relief in the main on those appeals, which indicate that Hampshire was not in a position to set policy for his employees. He had the Civil Service Commission of the city looking over him. Footnote 12 in Pembauer, the plurality opinion, we believe anticipated exactly the fact situation we have there. The court in that opinion hypothesized a county sheriff, a hypothetical county sheriff, who, while being the chief law enforcement officer, received rules and regulations in respect to employment from the county board of commissioners. In that hypothetical, that county sheriff, if he committed an unconstitutional act in respect to his employees, it would not impose a liability upon the county. Although if he acted in respect to his function as chief law enforcement officer, liability would be imposed. That is what we believe is exactly what we have in this record in respect to the defendant Hampshire.
Who was the policymaker in your view in this case?
Yeah.
The commission?
The Civil Service Commission...
They set the rules of the game about hiring and firing and transferring?
Yes. We have a charter amendment that specifically sets up a civil service system, and it gives our Civil Service Commission rulemaking authority, and they have been recognized...
And people like Hampshire just are supposed to take acts consistent with that policy.
Yes, that's correct. Even if
Mr. Wilson, if your view is correct, why wouldn't it be in the interest of every municipality to confer all policy-making authority for everything upon one individual, say the mayor? And he can't possibly execute it all, certainly. So de facto, a lot of people beneath the mayor are really making policy. But he doesn't know what those policies are, in fact. He just doesn't have the time to set them all. So then there would be no municipal policy on any of these things established by the only person authorized by law to establish them, and there would never be any 1983 liability. Isn't that what everybody ought to do?
Well, I guess if I could explain, Justice Scalia, I believe that that would call into play a second type of Monell liability, and that is what we would find as custom and usage. If you delegated out authority, and with the passage of time, it became open and notorious that there were widespread unconstitutional practices, then I think there attaches liability on the city because the policymaker, the mayor, in your hypothetical.
Well, then it's not a question of law exclusively, as you told us earlier.
In respect, I think, to single incident liability. Now, we're separating out the types of Monell liability. I think there are three kinds. There's general rules of application, I think there's custom and usage, and I think there is a third type of liability, which I would call single-incident liability. Under Pembauer, I think the threshold question is who is a policymaker, and that, we would believe, is purely a question of law. If we're in the second category, custom and usage and practice, then that would raise a number of factual issues for a jury.
I see. And you would not have to trace that... That custom or usage to the knowledge of the policymaking official. Liability would exist whether or not the policymaking official knew of the custom or usage.
I think that is an open question, and I think the Fifth Circuit, which rendered an opinion on this particular issue, felt that constructive knowledge was enough in that instance to impose liability, constructive knowledge on the part, even though the Fifth Circuit is clearly in conflict with our present decision from the Eighth Circuit because they abandoned the what we categorize as the final authority test. I think the key here is, unlike the prosecutor in Pembauer, Hampshire had substantive constraints upon the scope of his employment decisions. The dissent in the Eighth Circuit, I think, captured the significance of these restraints in our appendix to our petition. Judge Ross stated, the civil service rules permit appointing authorities discretion in making personnel decisions, but do not grant them the power to set personnel policy. Yes, that's in our brief, in our petition at A22, Judge Ross's dissent, which I might add cited the footnote 12 from Pembauer and set the footnote out verbatim, indicating his belief that it's squarely on the facts in the present record.
Suppose it was perfectly plain that the charter or the city council or whoever actually delegated to Hampshire the policy-making authority to set the rules of the game. And he just happened in a particular case to make a retaliatory discharge, quite contrary to to his own policy. Would there be municipal liability then?
Contrary to his own?
Yeah, well, certainly he didn't set up publish a policy of discriminatory discharges.
No, that's correct.
So, but he did make a discriminatory discharge, and he was the policymaker. Is there municipal liability then?
Under that hypothetical, we would say no. Hampshire would still be circumscribed in the city of St. Louis by the Civil Service Commission rules. He would not be a policymaker because I think there's other
You're just not accepting my hypothesis, but that's all right.
If I may, Justice White,
go ahead.
If there was a delegation of authority, if it was a lawful delegation, I think you're going to have difficulty finding lawful delegations of authority. But assuming there was lawful delegation from the policymaker to another city official, then that city official would take on the responsibilities of a policymaker under Monell.
Well, what if a lower-ranking city official assumes the responsibility for making decisions that could be interpreted as policy decisions? Now, are there circumstances in which the city could be found liable for the exercise of those decisions? For example, if a higher authority knows or should have known about those actions of lower-ranking employees?
I think in respect to single incidents, we would say no, unless the Civil Service Commission in this instance would have had actual knowledge that the transfer was impermissibly
or constructive
motivated.
Knowledge?
We would say that there would be clearly no liability in that particular case. Now, if you get into a widespread practice over a passage of time that's open and notorious, there we have the question that I think I attempted to answer with Judge Scalia. Their constructive knowledge could operate to impose municipal liability, but not in respect to a single incident, unless the policy.
What is open and notorious is not the particular policy that has been adopted by the delegee, the de facto delegee, but what is open and notorious is merely the fact of delegation, merely the fact that the Civil Service Commission is not making the policies, that it is allowing people out there to establish their own policies. What if that is open and notorious? Not the nature of each policy, but just the fact that the mayor or the Civil Service Commission is not running the show.
If, again, we're in the second category, custom and practice, liability can occur where there's acquiescence by the policymaker
in the mere delegation, not in the particular policies adopted.
In the mere delegation, no, we would say not. We would say, again, you'd have to look at the state law. If there's an unlawful delegation, that would not satisfy what we understand the test of Pembauer, the plurality, to indicate, that you have to look to the authority that's been granted by state statute or city charter or ordinance. If there were an unlawful delegation, that would not transfer on to the delegee the ability to impose municipal liability.
So the mayor can leave it to somebody, and so long as that person does not act consistently enough to establish a policy that becomes open and notorious, there can be no municipal liability.
Is that
an accurate statement?
That's our position, yes. The concurring opinions in Pembauer by Justice White and joined in by Justice O'Connor indicate, and they are at variance with the plurality, although I think if applied here would reach the same result, which would be reversal, would indicate that where the law has placed limits on the city official and he acts contrary to and outside those limits, that his acts cannot be considered to be policies of the governmental entity. Applied here, clearly there was criteria through our civil service system and parameters on the defendant Hampshire. The civil service system has specifically provided in its charter amendment that the system is to be run on merit and fitness based upon service ratings. There's a right of appeal that's been specifically granted. I think that right of appeal in a civil service system carries with it by clear implication that you can't retaliate against an employee for exercising his right of appeal. If you did, you would then be attempting to take away indirectly what the law has conferred directly upon the employee, the right of appeal. Our rules and regulations forbid discrimination. It also provides a substantive rule in respect to transfers. You can't transfer an employee and have him meet a different test of fitness.
Mr. Wilson, can I ask you a question? I think it's rather important to your position that it be treated as a single incident case, because otherwise you might have multiple instances which amount to a custom. Could it get away from the single incident posture if several times this sort of thing happened to the same individual? Or would that still be a single incident as long as it's one individual?
Yes. That is not the record here, but yes, I would say in that hypothetical.
If there were several retaliatory adverse actions against this individual, you'd say that could amount to policy.
That would be still an ad hoc decision, yes, of the policymaker, whatever harm was done. That would be our position on it. Because you have a singular employee involved.
You're saying that still is a single incident. If the same thing happened to employee X six or seven times, that he was constantly treated in the same way, that would be a single incident, or would that amount to a custom? That's what I'm not clear on.
I think it might. I would be my position that that would still be a single incident.
What's the difference between
time would be irrelevant.
Six adverse actions for Mr. Smith and one adverse action for Mr. A, B, C, D, and E?
That would be my position. This would be analogous to the police chase, where you had the stretched over 3 hours and umpteen miles, and there were different shootings.
But I'm assuming three police chases of the same individual. Wouldn't that be the same, just as much a custom as chasing three different individuals?
I don't think it can establish a custom in a relationship with a single employee. I think that would be a single incident. The record does not.
No matter how often you repeated it.
If confined to that single employee.
What if the mayor calls people and he says, our policy is to get Kropotnik? Why isn't that a policy?
If the mayor did that, under our interpretation, the mayor would be a policymaker for certain instances along with the Civil Service Commission. That would be imposed municipal liability under a single incident, because the act, the impermissible conduct, comes from the policymaker.
But if a lower official says, our policy is to get Kropotnik, and that policy becomes notorious, at that level it's only a single incident.
Yes, until it would take on the custom and practice, which would have to be developed by the totality of facts.
Kropotnik, or not?
We would say not.
I thought so.
That would be our position. Could I, Your Honor, could I reserve the balance of my time?
Yes, Mr. Wilson. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Oldham.
If the Court please, Mr. Chief Justice, there is a substantial difference between our version of the facts and the version of the facts as presented by counsel for petitioner. I'd like to point out that this was a jury-tried case, and respondent is entitled to the benefit of all evidence in his favor and all reasonable inference drawn therefrom. Now, there are certain facts that are not in dispute. It's stipulated that the acts against Kropotnik were done under color of law. It was stipulated that he was engaged in protected activity at the time he appealed his actions to the Civil Service Commission, and there was evidence that he was also engaged in protected activity when he made some criticism of the Sarah sculpture. The jury clearly found that Kropotnik had been subjected to retaliation because of his exercise of First Amendment rights. Now, I want to get briefly into the facts where we are in difference. For example, petitioner argues that Hampshire was solely responsible for the transfer of Kropotnik from a secure position inherent in the CDA to an insecure position at Heritage and Urban Design. Now, let me explain that situation. Kropotnik had a seniority position where he was a top seniority person. He had about 19 or 20 years of service at CDA. There were three or four people in his same position underneath him, so that in order to reach Kropotnik, they would have to lay off everybody underneath him in the same classification. He was moved from that position to a position at Heritage and Urban Design where he was the only person in that classification. Since we have departmental layoff, he was subject to immediate layoff. Now, in regard to the transfer, there are a few facts that led up to the transfer. There had been this situation with the Civil Service Commission. There had been acts of retaliation against Mr. Kropotnik in terms of taking away his personnel, reducing the scope of his responsibilities, things of this nature. After that, he was subpoenaed to appear before the Heritage and Urban Design Commission and to testify concerning the piece of sculpture, historic sculpture, which was ensconced on the front yard of the Civil Courts building in the city of St. Louis. He testified, and his testimony was not well received by the mayor, and he was immediately called in to Mr. Hampshire's office and told that he should have muffed it, that he shouldn't have given this particular information to the Heritage and Urban Design Commission. That was in the fall. The following spring, he was transferred. Now, the act of transfer in his particular situation involved not only the transfer of the individual, but the transfer of functions. In order to transfer functions, they had to get the approval of the Board of Estimate and Apportionment, which consisted of the mayor, the president of the Board of Aldermen, and the comptroller, the three highest elected officials of the city. They had to approve the transfer of functions. Now, testimony is...
By that, you mean they had to approve what amounted to some kind of reorganization or restructuring of city agencies.
That's right.
In terms of what a specific agency would do.
They had to approve the change of the budget and the change of the function so that they could be assigned over here.
Is that the evidence on which the jury was able to determine, if it did, that the mayor was linked to this?
That's part of the evidence. The other evidence is that Mr. Hampshire testified in his testimony that he went in and discussed this matter with the mayor, and he recommended the transfer of Mr. Kropotnik, and that the mayor made the decision to transfer Mr. Kropotnik, and that he, as a good, loyal servant of the mayor, followed his actions. That's in our brief. It's in the transcript.
So the change in the office of mayor, Mr. Oldham, sometime during these proceedings?
There was a Mr. Conway who was preceded and Mr. Shamel. And Mr. Spade was the CDA director who originally took the action against Kropotnik and suspended him and later reduced him in responsibilities. Then when Mr. Hampshire came in, there was this situation with the Sarah sculpture, there was a further reduction of responsibilities, and after that, the transfer of Mr. Kropotnik over to the Heritage and Urban Design Commission.
Mr. Oldham, may I inquire of your position whether, if there is a policy-making person or body of the city in charge of making policy for employment practices, hiring, transfers, and discharge, and if a lower-ranking employee supervisor has the authority to actually hire, fire, and transfer people, and if that lower-ranking employee decides for wholly improper reasons to make a retaliatory transfer and constructive discharge of an employee, without the knowledge or consent of the policy-making body, can the city be held liable?
Under 1983?
Yes.
Only in what we would consider an appropriate circumstances where the higher officials of the policy-making body was aware of what happened or had constructive notice of what happened and permitted
it. So you take the position that there would be no liability under the example I gave unless there was actual or constructive knowledge and or approval by the policy-making body. Is that it?
That is correct. Let me explain what happened in this case.
And do you take the position that here the mayor was the policy-maker or the Civil Service Commission?
All right. In this situation, which involved the transfer, the right to make transfers was delegated by the Civil Service Commission to Mr. Hampshire, the Director of Personnel, Mr. Duffy, and the receiving official, Mr. Jackson.
Well, was the Civil Service Commission the policy-making body?
For certain purposes, it is a policy-making body, and for certain other purposes, it is not.
The right to make transfers, which you say they delegated, is not necessarily the right to establish policy for transfers. Where do you assert that that resided?
Right. The policy for transfers was established in this case by the action of the mayor, the Board of ENA, and with the knowledge of the Civil Service Commission.
I'm not saying in this case. I'm saying as a matter of law, where do you think the power to establish policy for transfers resided within the city.
And so every city has a different situation. I think you have to look at the facts in any given situation and say, under these facts, the city, this individual may have policy-making authority. Under these facts, another individual might have policy-making authority. That's why we say that it's a factual situation, which is a question of fact for the jury.
You think the jury can determine all that, who's the policy-making authority for the city? It's completely open for the jury to determine.
I think it's a mixed question of law and fact, like many of things. But I think the jury, in this case, was instructed and given the instructions to determine who was the policymaker and whether or not these high officials represented the actions of the city. They were also told that the city can only be liable if it was part of a policy that was knowingly followed by the city. So that this was what was submitted to the jury in this case. And the jury then found the city responsible. And based upon that, it is our contention that the act of a transfer in this particular situation was a policy action. Now, let me explain that a little further. The decision of Hampshire, Jackson, Duffy, who was director of personnel, and the mayor, and the other two individuals I mentioned, the comptroller and president of the Board of Aldermen, to transfer Mr. Kropotnick was not subject to review.
Did the same mayor make all of these decisions that you're talking about?
Yes, the same mayor was involved. And now, in the first instance, the first suspension was done by Mr. Spade, who was then director of CDA under a different mayor. But Mr. Schemel was the mayor during most of this process.
And are you relying on the constructive discharge theory of the Eighth Circuit here?
Well, that's what happened.
Do you agree with the Eighth Circuit? Is that the theory?
I don't agree with some of the parts of the decision of the Eighth Circuit. For example, I don't necessarily agree that our case was predicated upon a final authority situation.
You don't agree with the final authority test. Do you agree with the constructive discharge theory that the court
adopted? I agree that there was a constructive discharge. The duties and responsibilities that Kropotnick were given were so menial for a person in his category as a licensed architect to reduce him to filing maps and do things of this nature constituted a constructive discharge.
Was the jury instructed on that theory?
No, they were asked if he was, the instructions were given, on which there were no objections made, that you could find the city liable if this was done by high officials. It's not limited to the three officials that we were named in the lawsuit. You have to remember that this was a long time process and that in August, prior to the trial, I attempted to amend the petition to bring in some additional named defendants, specifically the mayor, Mr. Nash, who was the director of the Department of Public Welfare, and others. And that petition was denied, so we were left in the posture where we were not able to get all the named defendants who had taken part in this particular action in that particular lawsuit. And we were left with the city as a defendant. Now, both myself and the attorney for the city pointed out to the jury that there were other high officials involved in this action, and that if these other high officials, and our contention was that these other high officials did it, then the city was liable, even if they should find that the three individuals were not responsible. So that's the posture that we found ourselves at the time of trial. And
you think that a single action of a constructive discharge, even if known by the mayor, can subject the city to 1983 liability?
Yes. When you have high officials of the government involved in this process, and you have the Civil Service Commission in a position where they know about it because they have an appeal pending before them which they have declined to hear, and they take no action on it. They say, we will not hear transfer appeals. Then when we have the layoff, we also file that appeal. And that appeal is still pending three or four years later. We don't think that this is an effective review. They have permitted this process to go on. And so they've had knowledge of this all during the time. It's not a question of constructive knowledge. They've had actual knowledge of what occurred.
Well, suppose the city, with knowledge of its mayor, just makes a discharge of a civil service employee without good cause. Now, does that result in 1983 liability if the city's policy is clearly stated not to be?
I think that you can, if you have a policymaker who makes a decision to violate somebody's constitutional rights.
Single decision.
Single decision. You have a policymaker who makes a single decision to violate somebody's constitutional rights, and there is no effective appeal process within the, you know, the city itself, then I think that that's a policy decision that's been made by the city.
How is that any different than just ordinary respondeat superior, which Monell said that they were not going to settle for in the case of municipal liability?
As I understand Monell, it also said that when a high public official or policymaker speaks on behalf of the city, that that can create liability.
It can create a policy, but I thought your answer to Justice O'Connor's question intimated that all you need is the one instance. You don't need any policy.
Well, I think that one instance is, and an isolate one instance can, in appropriate circumstances, create the policy which raises the issue of liability. I think that there are times when that occurs.
Well, then that really is just indistinguishable from respondeat superior, isn't it? That someone acting for the city did this, it violated someone's constitutional rights, therefore the city is liable.
Justice Rehnquist, I differentiate that because I talk about a policymaker having that right, a high public official. For example, it's agreed that if the school board of the city of St. Louis fires somebody because of their exercise of a constitutional right, that would create liability under 1983.
Even though it's hard to say that firing somebody for the exercise of constitutional rights is a policy of the city.
I think the courts have held there's liability under 1983, and I equate that with the same type of situation, Your Honor. And in this situation, we get back to the basic fact that this was a jury-tried case, that the jury found there was retaliation. The jury found liability on the part of the city. And one of the points that the city has talked about in its brief and has presented in its argument is that there's a basic inconsistency about the verdict which exonerates the three individuals and a verdict which finds the city liable. And that is not the posture of the case, because the instruction permitted you go beyond the three individuals. The arguments of counsel for the city pointed out that these three individuals weren't responsible, that there were other high public officials that were responsible. And I pointed out that there were other high officials that were responsible, so that the jury could, under the arguments and under the instructions, find liability for the city and excuse the three individuals.
Could, Mr. Oldham, could the employee who alleges a constructive discharge by virtue of a transfer file an appeal with the Civil Service Commission and get it heard?
No, not in this case. We asked for a...
Well, now, wait a minute. After he's lost his job, he's been riffed, and he comes in and he says, I was constructively discharged. Do we know that the commission would not consider hearing an appeal?
This is the one the commission refused to hear until the matter had been resolved by the courts. We filed an appeal.
Because it was already in court?
Oh, we were already in court on the transfer.
And so the commission said, as long as you're in court, we'll wait. Because the employee chose to take it to court.
Well, we were already in court on the transfer situation.
A suit had been filed by your client. That's why you were in court.
We had filed a complaint in federal court under Section 1983 alleging the transfer was a violation of his constitutional rights. And then after they went ahead and did the layoff, we then filed another appeal to the Civil Service Commission, and they refused to hear that. They placed it on the back burner where it's been all this time, so that we have not had an effective appeal process. There's another thing that the court must bear in mind, that on a layoff, the Civil Service Commission does not give you a full due process hearing. They limit the type of hearing that you can have.
Well, I take
this case only against the background of the transfer?
Well, I was responding to a question by Justice O'Connor.
Not in light of any kind of a discharge?
There was a constructive discharge in this case by that resulted from the transfer, yes, Your Honor, and then ultimately the layoff.
Well, how do we know it was a constructive discharge?
Well, the Court of Appeals, you know, in reviewing the evidence, felt that this was a constructive discharge.
But that wasn't how the jury had been instructed, so the jury didn't have that theory in front of it.
The jury was instructed on the transfer and the layoff. The jury was instructed on the transfer and the layoff. Said that so that both of those were involved in the jury instruction.
I take it that you don't let's assume that that it's perfectly clear that the commission makes transfer policy, and suppose the transfer policy says never transfer for retaliatory reasons, never. And some Mr. Herschler, or what is Herschler, is that his name?
Hampshire.
Nevertheless makes a retaliatory discharge or a transfer. Is the city liable? I don't think you don't urge that the city would be liable in that.
Not in every instance, Your Honor.
Well,
I think
if he acts quite contrary to an express policy, how can the city be liable on that?
Well, I think that if you look at the history of 1983, you had a situation in the South where
Just take my example. Do you think that the city is liable in that?
There are situations where the city would be liable. And those situations are where the decision was not made just by the low-level individual, but where other people had knowledge
of it. Let's just say it's made solely by that subordinate officer supposedly carrying out a policy, but he disobeys it.
All right. In a situation like that, Your Honor, I don't think there would be liability on the part of the city under 1983. But I'd like to point out that that's not the situation in this case.
Well, I take it then that you don't really defend the Court of Appeals rationale, this final authority business.
Your Honor, I think there has to be a little bit more than final authority process. I think that there has to be action taken by high public officials.
Yes.
And that's the theory upon which this case was tried. And that was the theory that was presented to the jury. And that was the theory that was presented in the instructions to the jury. And so that we have to look at this case in the posture in which it was tried before the jury. And those instructions, they might have been approved
upon. If we think that the Court of Appeals proceeded on the wrong legal basis doing what it did, shouldn't it have a chance to redo its appellate job based on the right rule of law?
Well, Your Honor, of course, that's one of the options available to the court, but I think that the court can also look at the basic case and say the decision of the Court of Appeals is right, but some of the reasoning was not correct, and you can give the correct reasoning and go ahead and affirm the judgment that we received.
Right.
I think that's entirely possible and within the framework of the court.
Let me just ask you if you agree that this is a single incident case.
I do not.
Why not?
Well, because actions against Propotnick covered a period of almost 3 years, and they covered a number of incidents. They involved, first of all, he was supposed to get a reprimand, saying that he had not obtained a clear understanding of the policy established by Mr. Spade. And instead, they reprimanded him for what he had originally been charged with before the Civil Service Commission and placed it in his personnel file. And even Mr. Kindleberger, the person who did it, admitted that he was in error on that or didn't do it right. There were other things that happened. Mr. Spade called him in, and they reduced his pay a couple of pay steps right after they had recommended him for a two-step increase, and this happened right after the civil service hearing. After that, his responsibilities were reduced. When Mr. Hampshire came in, they had the incident with the Sarah sculpture, and after that, things went really downhill, and he was reduced further in responsibilities. Much of his work was taken away from him. And then
But you don't give any other instances where any of these things was done to anyone else. So if there is a policy that, as opposed to a single incident that you're complaining about, it really is a get-Propodnik policy. Is that the policy
you're complaining about? That's about what happened, Judge, because I remember there was a federal
Do you think that's what a policy means in our decisions?
I think that
if you go out after an individual several times or in several ways, even though that's the ways you go after him are contrary to established principles laid down by the municipality, you have established a policy of getting that individual. Do you think that's within the fair meaning of our earlier
I think
case?
That's within the meaning of 1983. If you have a single isolated instance, that's one thing. That's something that happens within a relatively short period of time to one individual. But when you have a number of incidents that occur over a period of 3 years directed at that individual, I think you have a get-Propodnik policy. And I remember that the case of Harlow versus Fitzgerald, where there was a get-Fitzgerald policy, and somewhat similar, because Propodnik was as well known within the St. Louis hierarchy as Fitzgerald was within the federal government hierarchy. And I don't see how you can say that a person, that if a policy-making people and people who are in a position to make decisions that affect an individual and do so for unconstitutional reasons, that that doesn't create the city's liability on the part of the city. Because remember, in our instructions to the jury, we said that the high officials had to have the authority to speak for the city, and it could only be, city could only be held responsible where they did it knowingly and with knowledge. And so that's the posture of this particular case.
But the policy is to get this one man.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's single, isn't it?
Well,
I should have said get a single man.
But there were a number of incidents involving that single
man. That's all it was, one man.
One man. In this
Secondly, how much of this was given to the mayor, presented to the mayor?
Pardon, Your Honor.
How much of this was told to the mayor?
That's difficult to say because
in terms of records
to Mr. Propodnik, nobody said we're going to fire you because of this or we're going to transfer you because of this.
How do you get the mayor involved in this?
Because the mayor made the decision to transfer Mr. Propodnik and made the decision to transfer the functions, which incidentally were never transferred. In order to be legal under this charter, they had to transfer the functions over to the Division of Heritage and Urban Design. As a matter of fact, there's no record of any transfer of functions over to the Heritage and Urban Design. So that it indicates that even though there was decision made...
Did the mayor ever see the respondent?
Pardon?
Did the mayor ever lay his eyes on the respondent?
I think so, yes.
Is it in the record?
The record reflects that after
the record reflects that he didn't even know anything about this man, doesn't it?
Oh, no. The record reflects that he did know about the man.
Well, that's what I asked you. What is there in the record that shows the responsibility of the mayor to discharge this man?
The record reflects that the mayor made the decision to transfer him. The record reflects that the mayor made the decision to transfer his functions. The record reflects that the mayor was involved in being unhappy about his testimony about the Sarah sculpture. And in order for the court to understand that, the Sarah sculpture was being promoted by Emily Pulitzer, who is the wife of Joe Pulitzer, who owns the Post Dispatch, whose position is important to the mayor. And they had proposed the Sarah sculpture to be put out in the front yard of the courthouse. And when he testified that there were some problems with the Sarah sculpture, then, under oath, before the Heritage and Urban Design Commission, he was called in and reprimanded by Mr. Hampshire, and he was told that he should have muffed the questions, that he should not have responded to them, that the mayor was unhappy. So that the mayor was involved in this situation and knew about it.
Somebody told somebody that the mayor was unhappy.
Yes.
That charges the mayor with firing him.
Mr. Hampshire.
Somebody told somebody that the mayor was unhappy.
So an agent of the mayor told Mr. Propodnik, his supervisor told Mr. Propodnik.
Is there anything in the record to show that the mayor was unhappy?
other than statements of his agents?
Is there anything other than hearsay in the record to show that the mayor was, quote, unhappy, end quote?
Your Honor, I don't think that the statement of an employee or agent of the mayor is hearsay. I think that that's, when you speak for your principal, that takes it beyond the hearsay stage. And so we have statements by the employees and agents of the mayor saying the mayor was unhappy. And I don't think that is hearsay. If the court please, I know my time is about up, and I think that our case should be affirmed for the reasons we stated, that high public officials were involved, that the jury verdict under the Seventh Amendment should be respected, and that the court should grant the relief we have requested.
Thank you, Mr. Oldham. Mr. Wilson, you have 3 minutes remaining.
We have now, in respondent's argument, interjected the mayor of the city of St. Louis into this dispute. I would like to, in reflecting the record, try to clarify or correct what I think have been some mischaracterizations of it. There was nothing in the record that indicates that the mayor ever had any personal involvement with the plaintiff. I question whether or not he knew of the plaintiff. The plaintiff was a middle manager, city planner. We were involved in a cutback of some community development funds that caused a shortfall of $35 million in the city budget, and what was attempted to be done was to transfer functions from this large department, the community development agency, to various other city agencies. The reference that the mayor knew of the transfer is actually a reference to his knowledge, obviously, that functions were being transferred. The plaintiff attempted at various times to involve 15 city officials into this dispute. His verdict director instruction, though, is quite clear, and I'd read from it, that the defendants Hampshire, Patterson, and Kimmelberger are high governmental officials with the right to make policy decisions.
Yes, but, Mr. Wilson, as I understand, you're relying on your motion for a directed verdict at the close of his case.
Yes, that's correct.
Allows your opponent to rely on evidence in the record, even though it might not have been referred to in the instructions.
Yes, that's correct. We're pointing out, though, his theory of the case in no way is directed to the mayor as a policy.
At the directed verdict stage, you're not really debating the theory of the case, whether there's any evidence that would sustain liability under 1983.
Yeah, right. I think Justice Stevens, I think we get to the point of attempting to identify the policymaker. And I think for that purpose, we wanted to make sure that it was clear that the mayor, who may be along with the Civil Service Commission to be a policymaker, was not in any way involved in this particular retaliatory transfer. That was found by the Eighth Circuit to be the act of the defendant Hampshire. And I think that is the question, is whether or not the defendant Hampshire was a policymaker under state law. In respect to the appeal from the layoff that Mr. Oldham described, which I would have to disagree with. I think the constructive discharge appeal would give the plaintiff a right to a full hearing, either before the Civil Service Commission or under our state law, de novo, in the circuit court.
Your time has expired, Mr. Wilson. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.